Stand by for record. You're listening to Pop Corn Forest.
Was that okay? Can I cut into your outro like that?
I mean, I had no choice. But
you always have a choice. No, do you want to do it again? You can do it again if you want.
It's been another episode of
Fee-fi-fo-fum.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you talking to me? Sorry, can you repeat the question one more time?
I huff and I puff.
And those 4 months were excruciatingly bad.
Whoa.
Just because, like, you waste away. Like, I wasn't doing anything. Like, I wasn't, didn't have any like there was no progress being made, that sort of thing. I just feel like if you, that's why I can't understand like how some people are like, oh yeah, if I won the lottery, like I'd just quit my job and then just live however. I mean, I imagine if they're going out and doing things, but like my idea of like you know, kind of my ideal is just sitting at home doing nothing. Mm-hmm. But humans by nature are social creatures, so also, I need that aspect, and I couldn't just sit at home and do nothing. Also, the 2 times that I was not doing anything when I was unemployed was also because the first one, I had just moved, so I didn't know anybody. So the only people I was talking to was my family. So that's why, because if I had friends that I knew in North Carolina, like, I would have gone and hung out with them, you know, and like that would have been a substitute for the social aspect of like a job or school. But then the other time was when I moved here and I didn't know anybody. So I was just like talking to my roommate or whatever. And then I didn't get a job for the first 2 months, both times I moved. Until eventually it became too much to where I was like, I need money to live. Also, I'm miserable. So I'm going to get a job, you know? And that was just kind of the thing. Because I feel like it would be possible to not have a set schedule and be satisfied and happy as long as you have other things that you are occasionally doing. You're like substituting.
But, lawn bowling.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is, like some structure or like some recurring like suite of activities or engagements would be enough to like supplement all the other time that's like unstructured.
Mm-hmm. I would say so. I think so. I had another thought.
Yeah.
I'm reaching for it. I'm grasping for it.
Reaching for a thought. It's out there in the dark.
Where did my thought go? Who took my thought? I want that thought. I think about it a lot. Could you allot me some time? I would like to rewind back to when I had my thought, but now it's all for naught.
Yeah, did that bring it closer or
further?
Okay.
If anything, that was just the wrong thing to do, because now I definitely can't remember it, yeah.
Well, I remember that you were talking about like structured time, eating a sandwich, walking around, then you had jobs. You were unemployed for 2 months. Then you like were kind of going stir crazy, talking to your roommate.
Yeah.
And then you were forced by like economic pressures to get a job. And then you were talking about how you could have like activities that were like things that you could return to that would give you like the feeling of structure, but like a job but different. And then that would be okay. And then it was almost up to the point where you're like, and there's another thought that I'm reaching towards.
And then can you sing the song that I sang?
It had good rhymes.
It had bars. It's fucking bars.
What about like the most beautiful experiences that you've had in your life? Like broad boundary definition of beauty. It could be visual, but it could also be like experiential.
I'm not really like a visual. Like I don't really like, this is a one thing, because my mom would always be like, wow, isn't it so pretty here in North Carolina? Isn't it so beautiful? Look at all the trees. Isn't this so great?
Yeah.
And it just never really did anything for me. Like, obviously, like, I think there are some, like, visual spectacles that are pretty cool. But, like, I don't think I've ever witnessed something visually in my life and been like, man. Like, appreciated it, I guess.
Yeah.
I just don't know if it's something that, like, I don't know. If it's something that, not that I'm capable of, but it's just, like, it's not really something I'm into, I guess. Because like, I appreciate it and everything, but it's not like a huge thing for me, I suppose. I don't know. Most beautiful thing. I don't know. I mean, I always just derive enjoyment from like entertaining people. I feel like that's pretty, because that's not really like one particular instance.
Yeah.
But it's just like in a day to day, you know, if I can make somebody laugh or like put on a little show for them, give them a little razzle dazzle, you know, kind of break their conditioning, soften their hardened minds.
You specifically want to like kind of poke at the like the routine kind of aspect of,
yeah.
Is that a fair?
I would say like, it's a fair. I have, yeah. I mean, that was definitely more of a thing. Like when I have the like the free flowing trains of thought, that's what I enjoy doing. When I have other like worries or concerns or issues, then it's harder to do. But it is something I always enjoyed. And like I remember when I worked in North Carolina, or like when I was living over there, like I would always just. Like I made it like my specific purpose was or something that I just really, my thing was always just telling people some really outlandish shit and just seeing how they react just because it was funny, you know. And it's cool too because, you know, I'm not good at giving people any sort of like, I guess, positive affirmation or like pointing out good things about people, mm-hmm. I guess. I'm just always like kind of talking at people or, and never really like, oh wow, like you're a really good friend. Like I've never really been that kind of person, but I've really enjoyed when people that I talk to, like tell me like, oh yeah, you know, you're a funny guy. You're a real wisecracking son of a gun, you know? And people showing like, you know, that sort of like, affirmation for the things I do, kind of like what fuel me, where I'm like, oh, okay, I'm doing a good thing, or like I'm like, this is something that I like, you know.
It's like a what I was gonna use the meaning word, but I'm like trying to get away from that word now. There's a like a reciprocity in doing that, that like, that feels good for you.
Yeah. It's sort of like give and take, like the exchange is I go up and I act a fool towards somebody and they're like, hey man, you're really funny. Hey man, you're so quick with it.
That's
true. Yeah. You're quick on your feet. You know what you're snappy. It's sort of like a trade deal. It's sort of like the greatest trade deal there is. I make joke, they tell me I'm funny, and that's my purpose.
And what about in like the circumstances where like they don't tell you you're funny?
That's never happened before.
Then what?
No, it's happened before. Well, then I just, I don't know, cry. Feel defeated. Take my roast out of the oven. I don't know. I just change my approach, I guess, if something's not funny to someone. Because lately I've been getting a lot more, because I also am really bad about thinking, because this is the thing too, because it's always been ingrained to me from the time that I was younger, yeah, where like I had this idea in my mind that I always had to be funny, or like I always had to make people laugh. And
it's
whenever,
like a free will thing.
Yeah, but and I feel like that really fucked with me, where I was like, whenever like it's a group setting or whatever, and other people are making jokes or whatever, or if someone was ever being funnier than me, I couldn't just like stop and smell the roses and like enjoy it and be like, oh yeah, that's funny. Like, I don't know. There's like some sort of weird like sense of competition in my mind where I'm like, oh, I have to like compete or like do something better. And it was, it's pretty self-destructive. And not a good way of thinking. But yeah, so that was just kind of something I always kind of had to, kind of a mental trapping. And because of that, like I never really, I think the it's pretty bad, but like the hardest times I laugh are like at jokes that I make. Where I'm like, damn, that was a good one. That was a singer. But yeah, I don't know. I wish I could just kind of like, and this is another thing where I feel like the mental trappings of a schedule and regiment and like what our purpose is and who we are. I just can't like fully let it go and just kind of appreciate like whatever the current circumstance is and just kind of be in the moment. It's always like there's layers to everything, you know, where it's like people's personalities and relationships you have with people, and what do I want people to think about me, or how do I want them to react in this particular moment to what I'm saying, or like how do I want to steer this this conversation, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot about like, for me, it's like my way of like thinking about what you're saying is like, oh, is it like, how do I live in the world in a way that's like present, and what does present mean to me? And I think one of the big aspects of like being present is that like, there's either like a reduced or there's like even like no kind of like interior like monologue or like sense of like trying to like be aware of a lot of data in some sort of like, I don't know, like where I'm trying to stay ahead or like I'm trying to stay on top of like all the information in order to like manage it the correct way. But I also, because I'm like asking myself that question, like as we're talking, like, well, why don't you just like let go more often? But I know a big part of it is that I look back and I see all the times where I've said things that have been like hurtful to people, to where I'm like, well, I can't just let go, because if I do, like I can go so far in the other direction that it's like, you know, you can't just say whatever thought comes in your mind and like, yeah, hope for the best, because then like that's how people get really hurt. And so
That is, yeah, a big thing that I've had to deal with is kind of like taking things too far, taking jokes too far, and like, it's always like, and it's, because I feel like there are certain ways where we are as people where it's like, you just kind of naturally are a certain way. And certain behaviors are ingrained in you. And I think after a certain point, it's, you can keep apologizing for your actions, but and feel bad about it. So like an instance for me, or for instance, with me, if I'm making jokes that are like basically like shitting on people, mm-hmm. or like obviously I'm not coming at it from a place of trying to like harm, you know, it's not like malicious intent.
Mm-hmm. You're not like, I really want to like bring, like put this person on their knees, or like, I really want them to feel defeated. It's like
shock value, where it's like, you know, this is such a ridiculous thing to like a not good thing to say to somebody that that's, it's like, oh, why would you say that? And that's what makes it funny to me anyway.
Yeah.
In my mind.
It's like ruffling the feathers or.
Yeah. And if I keep doing that, right, and if I do that to somebody and then I apologize for it and I feel bad about it, but then eventually, like, I get in a good mood again and I feel fine, I feel secure, and then I accidentally take things too far again and make another joke like that, and then I have to apologize again.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a thing of, do you actually feel bad and are you actually sorry, or are you just... like trying to, because if you're actually sorry,
yeah,
the choice you have, the choice, the only choice to make is to stop the behavior, like, and cut it out, and then actually like try and change and be better. So it's either that's your one option, and then the other option is just accept that this is part of who you are, and these are things you're gonna do, and you're going to upset people with jokes sometimes. And just recognize that sometimes you're going to piss people off and then they're not going to like it, and just deal with the ramifications of that. So it has been kind of a weird thing where, like, throughout my life I've it reoccurs to where I'll take a joke too far and I'll be like, oh, I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
That was something I shouldn't have done, you know? And I don't know. It's like, but I think it's just something ingrained in me where that's like kind of what my humor is. And the problem is that we're not all going to line up as people. And I don't know if it makes me like a bad person for that, but I don't know. It's just kind of like, I don't know how much of that behavior is actually changeable and how much of it is. And I feel like that does sound like an excuse where it's like, well, you're not actually changing. Because I feel like mainly I just recognize like who doesn't react well to that kind of humor, and then I just change around them. But I'm not changing the actual, like, myself, you know?
It makes me think of like... like I'm imagining you, and like, if you have like a romantic life partner, which I don't want to speak for you and say you do, but anyway, this is the mental picture I have, is like you lying in bed with your romantic partner, and then you're both like kind of making like dirty jokes or like one-upping each other, or it's like you find the relationship where, like, you know, where like you can feel safe, but then like, I guess I'm also thinking about like you find the relationship where you can. Now I'm just like, I'm fucking describing like fucking like ideas about how you should be. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. But I was like, but it's like, well, you do want a little bit of like feedback about like, you know, things that might be worth looking into changing. Right. Or not. I'm not even talking about the humor thing now. Oh. Like, but just in general, like, aren't there some things that are worth like looking into about like wanting to change your behavior in on some like aspect?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, for sure. That's just, yeah. Cause I don't think I ever do anything wrong in my life. Except for that.
Like accidentally taking it too far.
Yeah. That's my only flaw as a human.
I can see it because it's tattooed on your bicep there. Yeah. That's how I know it's true.
Yeah, my 20-inch bicep.
There's just the word flaws with an X over it.
No, but yeah, I think that it's, you know, we all, no one's ever like, I can't get any better as a person.
Yeah.
You know, I'm set, you know, like there's nothing that I could possibly change about myself to make myself any better. But I think that what I'm trying to say is, like, if you're doing something that you know is bad,
mm-hmm.
and you keep doing it, just stop apologizing for it, because it's just part of who you are, you know, that sort of thing.
What about, I'm thinking of for myself, but so that's option A, or like you could decide to like really then change it, but it's also getting to this territory of like, if I change, I'm thinking about like, well, what if you're like a serial killer and you're like, well, I know I can't do that. Or like you're a serial killer, just like, or you like, you have like murderous intent, but you're like, I don't want to actually murder somebody. Like how, I don't actually know exactly how people like.
I mean, if I was a serial killer.
Yeah.
I'd just accept the fact that I have to kill people.
No. Yeah. What? That, I feel like that's not, I feel like that is like introducing too much by saying if I were a serial killer versus like if you are actually a serial killer, like how do you know? Like how do you know that's what you...
Well, I'm assuming your brain would be telling you I have to kill somebody.
But then there are people that are like, you know, they like... There's this podcast I used to listen to called The Mental Illness Happy Hour. And there would be people that call it like write in with surveys and they talk about like, oh, you know, like I've had like thoughts of like pedophilia, but like I don't act on it. And so it's like, I don't know. I'm thinking about all these different cases where it's like, how do you like, I don't know, like navigate the world with the sense of like there's like some tendencies that like should never be given into versus like things like this where it's like, yeah, maybe it's like totally fine if like not everyone likes like a certain flavor of humor like that shouldn't be the goal to begin with. Like, you know, there's plenty of diversity out there that we can all like find people that are, but I'm not sure if this question is like coming across. And
well, I think I get what you're saying. Like, where we're drawing the line on certain behaviors,
yeah,
and how,
yeah,
we,
and like how should you know how to like draw the line?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably subjective. I'm assuming, I just don't think that you can get like every person to agree on like a. Well, that's why we have laws. Like, at least in America, it's not against the law to make a joke someone doesn't like, you know?
That is a really funny sci-fi idea, or it's a very good sci-fi idea.
Well, yeah, it's like Big Brother. It's like 1948, like,
yeah,
thought policing, you know? But yeah, I think the law is a good place to start for that. It's also like the damage of certain behaviors, like the ramifications of them. Like if I'm making jokes that people don't like, just going back to that as an example, like the ramifications of that are I hurt somebody with my words and they like me less, or they don't like me at all, or stop talking to me, or whatever. And that's just on an individual level. I don't think that the damage there is like, and I'm not saying that I'm not going out of my way to be like, fuck you. Like, I'm going to make my jokes. I'm going to shit on you, you know, and if you don't like it, again, I don't know. But I also like try not to, it's just the adaptability and like kind of talking to people in ways that are suited to them.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily, because some people would say that that's just being fake, but I don't think it's necessarily being fake, but more so like being socially aware, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm more so
talking from like a perspective of people who other people in your life who, like, if you have a problem with the way that other people in your life do things or like something that they're doing, and you're like, hey, I don't like this thing that you're doing. And they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that I did that. But then they go and do the same thing again, like a while later. Then it's like there's no actual change that's happening. And it's like, well, don't say you're sorry then. Because you're not. You're not sorry if you keep doing it.
Like the best apology is a change of behavior kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's like... Like if your spouse cheated on you, mm-hmm. and then they're like, I'm sorry I did that. And then you're like, ah, oh, no, it's fine. I forgive you.
It's not fine.
You know, and she's like, or they're like, oh, yeah, I'll never do it again.
Yeah.
And they do it again. The initial apology obviously never meant anything. It's just like the recovering of the relationship, or like, I'm afraid to lose this relationship, so... I'm just gonna pretend like I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like people should be sincere in apologies. Sorry isn't a word to be used lightly.
Like, don't apologize until, like, you can do it for real. Even if, I mean, I'm thinking of like, it's like, oh, it's better to have one good apology than like 11 like fake apologies.
Yeah, pretty much.
This is a fascinating theme.
Yeah.
I want to think about this for like the rest of my life.
You know what I think about? I think about the fact that I've only brushed my teeth and peed at the same time once.
Like, just, you're just like, oh, I got to do it again? Or like...
Like, I want to feel that... Happen? Like, the thing is, I want to feel that high again.
Yeah.
But at the same time, now that I know I've done it,
yeah,
once already, it's not going to be the same. There's no time like that first, you know, that rush of realization.
What else is like waiting out there for you to discover?
I don't think I've brushed my teeth while taking a shit before, so maybe that. I feel like that's kind of the next logical step.
I feel like it's grody, but maybe, I don't know, the two cancel each other out.
Yeah. Well, it's like you're cleaning the entrance,
yeah,
while dirtying the exit, essentially.
Are you dirtying the exit? I feel like the exit's designed for...
I mean, it's getting dirtied. It's getting sullied. That's why you wipe it after.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. At least on the surface.
This episode's not for everybody.
This episode brought to you by Dude Wipes. Wipe your ass. Wipe your nasty ass with Dude Wipes.
What about places in your life where you've had the experience of like persevering or like working really hard at something in spite of like feeling like maybe it wasn't worth it, but like doing it anyway, and with the possibility of like multiple outcomes of like realizing that it wasn't really worth doing, putting in the effort, and or times where like it was worth putting in like a lot of effort.
I guess school's the big example for it not being worth any effort, because
really,
yeah. I went to community college in North Carolina, and when I started, I think it was 2020. Yeah. Cause it was right when COVID started. So I was in school for like a couple months, and then COVID happened, and then I dropped out. But I like that whole, the whole situation mm-hmm. that I handled it, was like the worst possible way I could have ever handled, dropping out. Because I initially enrolled and I had just moved states. So I didn't qualify for in-state tuition. So I was already paying three times the amount that I would have if I had just waited a year to go. And then I was doing terribly in my classes anyway, because I was working at the same time.
and I like just kind of thought I could wing it, yeah. like I always did in school. But I had never worked in high school, so I didn't have to deal with the balancing of the two. And I took way too many classes. And
wow.
I think, yeah, well, I had like four or five, I think, while I had a full, like working 5 days a week.
Three is like
yeah.
a lot
yeah.
so I, to work.
Yeah, I would go to school in the morning and then go to work after. And it like left me no time. Like I would have math exams that were due at like 12 and I would get out at like 11:30 and it was shit. And then I ended up dropping out, but it was like when they had shifted to online class. But then I made the decision to drop out, but I was way too lazy and I didn't do it in time. So I could have, instead of dropping out, because it like during COVID you had the choice to withdraw and it would like none of it would go on your record or anything.
Oh, okay.
And I think that might also be a thing, like if it's early enough in the school year, just in general, I'm not sure. But I waited too long and I just dropped out from all my classes, but they're all on my permanent record as me failing the classes.
Oh, okay.
So I spent like almost three grand on a semester just to fail every single class. Nice. And then never go back. So that was probably the one time where I was like, man, that amounted to nothing. That was a waste of time and money. Yeah. But most things that I've done, I feel like it's never been wasted effort. I feel like there's, I mean, even in things that you fail in, there's always like positive things to take away from it or like lessons to be learned from it. Like I learned that I shouldn't spend $3,000 on a community college in North Carolina during a pandemic. It's a very specific lesson to learn, but I learned it regardless.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, working at different places, it's like you just get different experiences, just meeting like different people, I guess, and different people in like managerial positions or just like and the circumstances that bring people to these jobs, where it's just kind of interesting to me, like just the fact that everyone has their own circumstances and we're all like the main concerns of ourselves. And
like we're all looking out for our own yeah, lives and our
yeah,
survival.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we're always number one to ourselves. And it's pretty interesting to take a step back for just a moment and not think about myself.
Yeah.
And just kind of like look around and be like, wow, all these people are like, they got their own shit going on. Like they're pursuing their own goals. It's pretty cool. It's like we're all in a movie, but we're all the main character. But you're just like watching the different director's cut of each character.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Yeah. You can like press the remote and you can switch the point of view.
It makes me want to like make a, I mean, I think that's what like good movies are about, but I've always liked movies that are like about like five or six characters and it's like all their points of views, or there's like, I'm thinking of like Lost when there was like, they would do the backstory of like every character. And I remember the first time seeing that and be like, this is so cool. It's like every character matters or like every character is unique. And then you like can't.
And they all connect to each other with their backstories, like how they got to the island and everything.
I forgot about that. There's like, you're saying that they were like their timelines were connected before they get actually like on the plane.
Like there's certain, like you'll see in one character's backstory like circumstances or like a reference to another character and how like they all kind of affected each other or like their destinies intertwine. I loved Lost in sixth grade. I loved Lost.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
I like binged it for 2 weeks straight and then it was the only thing I was doing. And then after I finished it, I fell into a deep depression because I didn't know what to do with my time anymore because all my free time was devoted on Lost. So I forgot what I usually did.
Yeah. You're like, now what?
Yeah, and I had to recover. Also, the ending was pretty bad. But
I struggled with the sense of like watching it when you're like, I don't think this was like conceived like as a whole group of like stories coming together. If it is, like, it doesn't feel that way. But I never made it. I made it to like season 3 or 4, and then I was like,
okay, yeah, that's when it was still really good.
And then I like heard about the ending, and I was like, oh, this is like interesting. But I'm like, I never met anyone that was like, you got to see through the whole thing to like, I don't know.
Yeah, I really hate it when shows, because I feel like with some shows where they go on for a while,
yeah,
you can kind of tell that like there was never a set plan for how it was going to end or like how things were going to progress. They were just kind of like making shit up on the fly and just kind of rolling with the punches.
Yeah.
So like that happened with Lost, and then they did that with Game of Thrones too once they ran out of book material. Yeah.
That should be another interview. I'm going to find somebody who worked on Lost and on Game of Thrones, or just somebody who's worked in,
what's his name? JJ?
JJ Abrams.
JJ Abrams.
Yeah. I'm going to
get JJ Abrams meet on the podcast
to talk about Honey.
JJ Abrams on Popcorn Forest talking lens flares.
I feel like it's both a fascinating reason and like a boring reason where it's like, oh, well, like nothing works perfectly like that. But then there are plenty of shows where it's like they don't have that outcome, and you feel like the quote quality like retains across the whole series. So I think really what I'm wondering is like, what are the particulars of like productions that, like what factors most go into the like quality of the production, you know, beforehand, and at which, like, is it where is it in the writing, or is like, is it in the funding, or is it like in the studio, or it's like, well, maybe the studio like had COVID, or maybe like a building caught on fire, or like maybe like a writer left like midway through the show. So I'm like, there's probably like so many different stories, but then,
yeah, I think 90% of the time it's the writing. Like, it's just they don't know where to take the story.
But aren't these, like, people that have, like, fought so hard for these, like, writing jobs? Or are you just saying that, like, even, like, the best writers sometimes, like, are not sure, like, where to go next?
I mean, yeah, I'm not going to...
I think there's
plenty of people in jobs that aren't qualified for those jobs.
Really?
Yeah. Everywhere. You know?
Facts.
Like at the highest of office, you know.
Why?
You could say that, like in 2016, I don't know if if you're telling me that everyone who has their job is qualified. but I don't know. I think that probably some people are just bad writers. I think I could do a much better job. Yeah. Well, also, I think because there is probably external pressures too when it comes to like big series where they want to extend it, or they want to, and then you're like stretching the story. And then you're messing with the structure of it to where then you're drawing it out. And then,
yeah.
And not everyone's perfect. Like, there's plenty of people that work on these great, successful projects, and then they have duds, you know? Like, not everything you write is going to be a hit. Yeah. Even for, like, people who are generally, like, highly acclaimed.
So this theme of, like, artistic integrity... Can we make a world where there's like, I hate that term though, but space where like the story is like not never, but less susceptible to the pressures of like being successful.
Can you rephrase the question?
Yeah, I'll just put the recorder in the toilet and mail you mail you the remains.
Can we make a world where it's possible for
For never to happen again, that like a story gets botched because it became successful and they're like, well, we got to extend it. Because it seems like in hindsight, there's this part of me that's like, well, it was never worth it because like everything that was beautiful about the show then like got canceled out, or it like it never got the chance to like be the story that like someone's heart had it out to be. And I do feel like that comes across to like viewers like in a very real way, to where it's like you've sinned against the viewer. You've like, mm-hmm. you've like promised people something that like then
yeah.
you've.
They beheaded my child in front of me.
You perfectly vibed it. Exactly. All these beheaded children and
no one to answer for it.
Well, I guess you could have a cheap answer and be like, well, studio executives or something.
Yeah. I think the problem too is like, because you have a writer's room
mm-hmm.
for a lot of things. And then there's
a lost writer's room.
Yeah. And I think that when you have too many writers on a project, everyone has their own ideas, then it's like you're getting so many different ideas from people who have ideas about how the story should go. But when you have all these, it's like you know,
is this going back to the toilet meme?
No. You know, like being drawn and quartered?
Yes. Oh, that's a great analogy.
Yeah. It's like there's four different writers and they all have almost completely opposite ideas of the way the story should go. And they're the guy is being pulled in four different directions until he just splits apart. And that's pretty much what it is. When you have, I feel like the best stories are conceived by a singular person who knows like the themes, thoughts, mm-hmm. motifs, and everything. But when it comes to like shows or movies, well, mainly shows, I feel like. I don't know if movies have as much of a, I'm sure a lot of them do have a huge writer's room, but too many cooks in the kitchen. That's the problem.
So even in like a highly individualistic society, which is what I'd say we have, to the extent that it's probably like coming with some severe drawbacks that like aren't fully accounted for in like the overall, like, I don't know, I want to say like well-being of the world, there's still a space for like the individual, like artistic vision of like a person, like has a meaningful contribution and the ability for it to like hold a story, in a way that can like somehow be, I don't know what you call it. Like, cause like, what is it? It's more true than the four people, or is that it doesn't like compete, or it's like, well, why can't four people like come together and have like a similar enough vision that like the four visions like coming together are like just as like compelling as like the unified vision, or the coordination is like there so that it supports.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think because it's so if you have a story and then someone starts out making it.
Yeah.
And then later on, it's like one person's original conception. And then later on, you start adding more people to it, and like, how can we collaborate on this, and make this like better? Then you start deviating from the original person's ideas. I feel like that's the problem. And sometimes it can make it better, but I think that it's just harder to make a cohesive narrative when it's multiple authors like adding in their own thoughts and like conflicting with, because then if they have two drastically different ideas of the way a story should go,
yeah,
what it
they're probably just going to end up compromising and meeting somewhere in the middle, and then neither of them are fulfilling their...
But why didn't they flush that out when they were doing like the hiring? Or why didn't they flush it out when they were like, I don't know, working on one episode? Or is it just takes time and you can't throw like a bullseye dart every time? Like,
it's just because they need to pump out episodes and make money. That's why.
So the pumping machine just has like an incredible amount of influence over the whole... Yeah,
they're just getting milked. It's a constant milking.
That's very sad.
Yeah. It's not good. I wish it could be different, but... I don't know.
Can a podcast make it different?
No. Podcasting can't change the world.
I want it to, but
I don't think anything can change the world. I think the world just is.
That can't be true.
No, I know. I just said that because it sounded provocative.
Okay. I mean, it was provocative.
You can open up the episode with that.
You should say your hottest name.
Oh, like full name?
I mean, however you want to be introduced.
It's me, Luke Fisher, and you're listening to Popcorn Forest.
That'll be the start of the episode, unless you record some poetry.
Not a big poetry guy. No. Not if there's multiple authors.
Maybe.
I can only...
Too many cooks in the kitchen.
Like this poetry... Like, it was really good up until the fourth stanza, and I can tell after once they hit the fourth stanza, they added, like, five people to the writer's room, and it all started, like, getting really disjointed.
Oh, okay. I feel like there's a part of my brain that's like, bro, you really need to wrap this up and, like, ask, like, one or two finished questions, and also another part of my brain that's thinking about, like, what about this notion that, like, there's like a bajillion bacteria in us, right? Or in like a bajillion cells. I promise this.
Where are you going with
this whole thing of like who you are is already like a multitude in like so many different ways that it's like, how is it though that like within one person there's like a crazy amount of like diversity of like life forms, and like even every mind of every person is like already like a crazy world, and sometimes even within one mind there's like an incredible amount of contradiction, and then within that ecosystem of like a person you have someone called like a writer or an artist who's like, I guess, ostensibly trying to do some kind of like organizational thing towards like a story that's cohesive. How is that like different than like, if you already have like in a way like multiple life forms inside you, what's so different about then like collaborating with another life form next to you? And I probably could have a way simpler version of this. That's like, what's the difference between good collaboration and like not good collaboration, or like what are the limits of collaboration, or like? But I think that's my like, I guess my question is like, can you make like, is it like a synchronized dance performance is like 20 cooks in the kitchen?
Yeah.
And of course there is a choreographer behind the scenes that's like, they decide the moves of all the dancers.
See, but that's just a dance with a choreographer.
Yeah.
Is just like a scene with a writer.
Yeah.
The dancers aren't writers in the room.
No.
They're actors. So they're not like the creatives. They're the... The what? Like, well, no, actors are creative. That's not, I'm not saying actors aren't creative, but they're not the ones who are like,
you have to get off the episode
now. Scripting the thing. You know what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes,
unless they're writer actors.
Well, yeah, unless they're writer actors, unless they're improvising their lines like some have done. But, and like, if it's a good addition, they'll keep it. If it's a bad addition, they'll cut it. But, you know, like the choreographer is essentially just the writer. But when you get five choreographers and they all have different ideas about how the dance should be, then they end up just like, you know, half the routines going one way, and then there's a huge tonal shift in the middle
And then they don't know how to, yeah, they don't know how to finish.
So you're saying that there are some like limits?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's all like, at the same time, I think it's good to have different people who have different ideas of what you should do.
Yeah.
On a, like, and this is just with, I feel like with, it's mostly for creative projects.
Yeah.
Because I think some things are pretty straightforward to where, like, collaboration is just always going to be good, you know? Like, if there's, really? Like, hey, we're going to, there's a rock. We have a really big rock.
Yeah.
And we need to get it in that hole.
Uh-huh. Oh, there. I really do want to already get the rock in the hole. I just, yeah. I need to push that rock.
And there's 15 of us. There's 15 of us, and we all got to get that rock in the hole.
Yeah.
I feel like collaboration on something like that is never going to end badly. Unless someone like really tries to take charge of it. No, I feel like, no, because collaboration always has potential to go bad. Because,
yeah,
like in a, if we're all stranded on a deserted island, and then there's always going to be someone that's like, all right, listen, everybody, this is what we're going to do. You got to listen to me. I'm the one who knows how to do everything. And then you have like clashing personalities and like people trying to take leadership roles, and then people don't agree with other people's ideals on how we should survive on this deserted island. And then it will inevitably lead to conflict. I think that the more people you introduce, the more personalities you let intermingle, just breeds the possibility and potentiality for conflict.
So in this, like, in what you're saying is then different than, like, you have, like, multitudes and multitudes and multitudes of cells in your body that are sometimes get in conflict. Like, sometimes cells become cancerous. But, like, on the whole, like, you got a shitload of little, like, creatures, like,
wriggling around inside.
Wriggling around kind of more or less, like, towards, like, a somewhat of a unified, I mean, like, your body, I would say, on the whole, like, tends to be more organized than disorganized, and that, like, usually people don't end up being, like, self-quartered by their, like, wayward biology. I think that's, like, the thought that's, like, really kind of that I am, like, hammering on inside of myself in terms of trying to understand, like,
like, because our body works like that, why can't everything?
Oh, yeah, work like exactly. That? Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm sure, yeah, there's been like societies that have like been way more collaborative. Uh-huh. And I agree with you, the potential is always there. But I guess human collaboration as a theme is like something that I'm now thinking, okay, I've gotta have some follow ups.
Well, but the thing is, your cells don't have personalities.
That's bullshit.
No, it's not.
I think there's now, like, I don't want to say research, but I think that there are people who are, like, working in biology that are, like, now starting to talk about, like, that even on, like, sort of these really minuscule levels, that there, like, is a kind of, like, agency that is, like, that goes down, like, in the scope to the level of, like, tiny little life forms. And I don't... of course, it's not the same as like the agency of people, but that, like, I think I'll have to go back and do show notes for that. But even like mushrooms, like the individual like cells on the like the tips of the, I think they're called hyphae. They like do all these different things that are like sensing their environment, and then like in some ways are, I want to say, make choices, but they're kind of doing a little bit like that. Does that mean they have personality? Maybe not. But I
just think that like these, if we're talking about in the human body, like our cells, and like, because that's, if that's your main point of contention, where our cells are working in conjunction with each other to make sure that we're living and that our systems are working.
Yeah. Or how about this, that like your heart has a different personality than your lungs?
I mean, my heart doesn't argue with me about like politics or religion.
Sure, it's not a perfect analogy. Yeah.
My heart doesn't have hot takes about necrophilia, you know, that...
Hot takes from the heart on necrophilia.
Yeah. My heart's not a convicted felon. It doesn't have potentiality to cause conflict within a group setting, I don't think. I think I know my heart a little bit.
But when you get to this, like, there's some level that you can, like, cross into, like, the territory of, like, human personality where, like, the potential for, like, would you say the potential for unity and, like, disorder is greater, or do you think it, like, it's biased towards, like, disorder once you get to, like, the level of human personality?
Yeah, I just think that the higher you go in terms of life, because certain forms of life are so infinitesimally small,
mm-hmm.
that they just exist and have their purpose, and like they do their duty, like you know, the heart pumps blood, like that's its function.
It does a lot more than that.
I mean, but it's not like, oh man, I'm getting tired. I need to go lay down. You know, like, yeah, like it doesn't have agency like that fully, right?
I don't know. I promise.
It hasn't stopped yet. I mean, I guess sometimes hearts do just fucking quit. They're lazy. Some of them are just fucking lazy, and then they're just like, I don't want to do this anymore. And then you die of heart failure.
We're in the writer's room right now, and I feel like I like having two cooks in this kitchen.
Yeah. Well, two cooks is fine. Two cooks can make a lovely meal together. But once you have like eight cooks and you're in like a 5x5 kitchen space in a studio apartment, things get a little messy.
You got to shrink the people down or expand the kitchen.
And sometimes my sous chef doesn't know how to cut the carrots properly.
Oh my God.
He doesn't even know how to dice onions.
No matter how many times you tell him. Yeah. He's like, come on.
He's not qualified for the position because there was faulty hiring and the training was mismanaged. But I think when you learn, I think when you get to the level of humanity,
okay,
human personality, human ego, I think ego is more of a thing than personality.
Ooh.
Like that causes conflict.
Man, this is a good can for, I mean, this is, I don't think we can get to this can on this episode, but maybe I can just ship my brain to you next week and you can decode it on your laptop and you can continue the conversation of, I'm sorry.
Put your brain in a jar.
Yeah.
And talk to you.
No, that's a good ass theme. Like, ego versus personality.
Yeah. Well, what is it? It's like the ego and the id and.
The super ego.
Super ego. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother thing.
I guess that could be like a good deep dive because I feel like everyone knows like the first two sentences of like that book. But then it's like, what was like the middle of the book about on this, the id, the ego, and the superego? And like what else has been suggested as a paradigm for understanding like the complexity of people?
Yeah. I just think, Not to like detract or anything, but I'm just going.
How dare you? I feel detracted.
Yeah. Well, just going back to what was it?
Egos and cooks.
Egos and cooks. They all think they're hot shit. They all know how to slow roast beef. They don't. Only a few select cooks do. And you should leave it to them. And. You know, the more, I think the main issue is like people, it's like, what is it? Is it the Overton window?
Oh my God, I can't believe, I really wanted to bring this up like 2 hours ago.
Where it's like the like sliding scale of like people overestimating their capabilities, or is that something else?
No, that's the
Dunning-Kruger effect. What's the Overton window?
Overton window is sort of about like the zeitgeist of culturally accepted ideas. You know, is necrophilia okay? Is necrophilia not okay?
Is it?
I would say hard no. But we can.
I don't know how my heart feels about that because it's got its own personality, its own thoughts. My brain feels one way.
The heart wants what the heart wants.
And the heart wants necrophilia.
Oh, God.
Don't cut that out. Don't you fucking cut this out, Ari.
When the Overton window is being tampered with as we speak. Okay, so.
You can tamper with my Overton window. You can affect my Dunning-Kruger.
You can put an avocado dry rub steak in a jar of honey anytime. Okay, but Dunning.
I feel like there's a miasma over this conversation.
Dunning-Kruger, then I'll ask you one final one. And
okay.
We'll call it.
Oh, I was just saying. Okay, yeah. So I think people just really want to be important and they no one wants to certain people are satisfied with just like basic things, but I feel like everyone wants to feel like they know the right way to do things or like they,
oh, yeah,
they know. Yeah. Like what their ideals for society are like what society should be.
And people that don't like feeling lost.
Yeah. And that's like what having a system of beliefs is. It's like, if you believe something, that's how you think things should be, you know? And if those are the things that you believe, like, I don't want to say that, like, naturally you think that everyone should think that way, but it's basically you trying to assert your will of, like, how society should be on others. So I think just the fact that there are different ways of, like, thinking of how things should be run, like you'll just always run into problems. Like, unless we all were pre-programmed to think and believe the exact same thing and we lived in a completely like non-individualistic society, war and conflict are inevitabilities that will happen. The only thing preventing us from that right now is mutually assured destruction.
I don't know enough about that topic to have like an informed opinion.
Well, just the nuclear option where we're going to destabilize the economy of and the livability of the planet too much. And that's why we don't really, I mean, obviously there are wars happening right now, but like we're not, at least I don't think, unless you get someone really fucking nuts in one of these like major powers, like whether it's us or like Russia, China. I mean, not to say that they aren't nuts now, but like unless they threw all caution to the wind and they were like, I'm gonna nuke, like I don't care, like I'm gonna use the nuke.
Yeah, just like nuke or like go home or nuke or go home.
Yeah, like I don't think we're ever gonna, not ever, I don't think we're currently gonna see any major world conflicts. Like I don't think we're gonna have another world war, at least on a major scale, to where it's actually escalating to the point where we're nuking each other, you know?
I hope not. I mean, it's super bizarre to think about this because you're like, there's no more podcasting. Or what would the podcast be like in the...
And I know people want to hear my thoughts on the realistic like chances of World War III. That's what people came to listen to.
Maybe. I mean, I think it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Mutually assured destruction.
Yeah, there's not. Suffice to say that, like, we're at a place now where to like take an inch, or what's that expression? Like, you know, you can't really just do like one nuke, or maybe you could, but it's like if you open up the can of worms, you could really badly. Yeah.
And I don't want to imply that I'm saying that there's not like people going to war and like, because obviously there's the stuff with Ukraine and like in Palestine and all that right now, but like I'm just speaking solely from the perspective of like we're not going to be drafted. I don't think it's going to get to that drastic point where like we're like we need every able-bodied man and woman because like the whole world is like fucking going for like gunning for each other, you know?
Yeah.
Like I'm talking like end game level war.
I mean, that would
total
be
total war.
Like, it's hard to talk about it in a way where it's like we're on the other side of this like alternate, potentially possible reality, but like hopefully one that's like very unlikely. But like, if that were to happen, it's like insane to think about the amount of just like the day-to-day life for like so many people would change if like the whole, or, I mean, I don't even know what it means to like do total war, but let's say like the top 10, like, you know, economic superpowers or like, you know, the top 10, like most populated countries. I'm like trying to play like World War III simulator in my head. I'm like, I don't even know if this is a good thing to be doing, but just that, like, yeah, like total war would like completely change like the lives of so many people in a way that I think it's like unrecognizable, I guess, except for previous wars where you're like, yep, like it's just down to like eating and sleeping now and like trying to like not get bombed. Yeah.
I don't know. I think part of it that's crazy to me is that like anytime the US has been involved in a war,
yeah,
it's always like there's never been any like fighting on US soil. Like we've had, obviously we had like September 11th, and we had, which wasn't really like part of, I guess it kicked off a war.
Yeah.
And then Pearl Harbor. But that was like an isolated like attack on Pearl Harbor.
Right.
It's not like we were like having people like in firefights in Chicago, like people invading the US, you know? And that's something that we've never had to deal with.
I mean, I guess like the Civil War, right, is like the
Well, yeah, I think when the British like burned down the White House in like the 1780s.
But no, like I think kind of to go back to what you're saying, like no modern, like saying between the 1900s.
But the Civil War was us fighting against each other, so. Yeah.
But not the way that, like, you know, Ukraine is, like, getting the shit bombed out of it, or people in Gaza, or every other place that, like, yeah, is.
Don't want to be exclusionary.
The home turf.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one thing when it's in your backyard. It's like another thing when, because, you know, like all the stuff with like when we were in Iran and Iraq.
Yeah.
It's like I was sitting at home.
Right.
Reading about it.
100%. You know? Yeah.
Like no one came here, but we sent people out there and they definitely had to deal with it, you know?
So if we just had a war on American soil, then like we would have empathy.
I think that's what I need. Empathy, not war on Earth. Cut that out. Cut that part out.
The more that we've talked, the more I'm just like, fuck it. We're just releasing the whole episode minus like 15 minutes where things were just getting started.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
If you're listening right now, you get a free,
you get a gold star. You get war in your backyard. That's what you get. You're getting drafted tomorrow. You're getting drafted on Popcorn Forest. We're going to send you to the battlefield. Lace up your boots, grab your weaponry. It's time to go to war. We endorse war here on Popcorn Forest. Give us your oil.
Provoked into silence.
We're coming for your oil.
How do you want to end it?
Did you have another? I thought you had another question because that led from me. That was me talking about
war.
How ego leads to conflict. Right.
Oh,
Good.
I was like, I can't think of it. I didn't want to do one of the like.
I really want you to wow me. Like I want a really good like solid final parting remark. Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if I could just like press a button and this whole like top half of the house like were to like kind of launch like a rocket, I'm sure that would really
that would wow me.
You'd be like, oh, I did not know that your house like was outfitted with this. I don't think that I can wow you on especially like off the cuff, but maybe, I don't know, is there like I was either thinking like, is there like, I don't know, something that you think a lot about that like maybe people like meeting you wouldn't know, like how much of the time like that kind of like thought or like way of thinking about the world is sort of like inside you, whether it's a positive or negative thing. Or I think I'm always fascinated with like, you know, just the way that there's like an aspect of you that like could never be like replicated in another person, yet I don't know exactly what that is. That's not a question. So
no.
And hardly wowing.
No, I mean you're just kind of like you're asking if there's just something about me that people wouldn't know at a glance. Or like
I don't know, do you have like
something
and like a dream for your life or like a...
Oh, God, no.
Like a... I don't know, or... Like a... I don't know, like a thing that like keeps you up at night that like, you know, just like, oh, I like... I feel like these are more, I'm like, yeah. Oh, I think this is really not like me asking you questions that like I would think about for myself. I'm like, that's not what
I
want. Yeah,
no, I want it to be free. I want it to be for you. I want it to be something that really sings from your soul and like kind of caresses me in a questioning manner.
Caresses you?
Not in an interrogatory manner.
In an interrogatory manner?
Yeah.
What are you going to do after this?
I'm going to go home. I might make some bulldog. I got some bulldog.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. I never had it before, but my friend's really hyping it up, so give it a whirl. I need to get my cookery out of my boxes.
Yeah. Is this like early in the night for you, or usually like this is like bedtime?
I usually go to sleep at like 4.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
3 or 4.
So the night is like youngish?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there's bulldog and what will you do when you go home?
I mean, I'll probably eat the bulldog. I'll probably
eat the bulldog.
Probably hit my vape.
Hit the vape.
Play some games. Listen to Popcorn Forest.
No.
You don't want me to?
I mean, you can.
You just don't think I'm going to.
I think that you, I believe that you, that it's a possibility that could happen.
That's a really diplomatic answer.
No, I mean, like, if I can imagine a scenario where on Spotify you look it up and you're like, oh, there's this episode with Perp. Like, I'll listen to it, like, casually. Mm. I think in my head I was specifically thinking, will you listen to this episode? And I'm like, I have no idea. And if you do, it'll be...
I would love to listen to this.
I'm just like, oh my God, I better have like a whole day ahead of me.
I'm really glad I didn't drink anything before I came over here. No, because I was like, maybe I could do that. Maybe it would like loosen me up. But I was like, no, I feel like it would really like be like against the spirit of this to like feel the need to be inebriated to talk to somebody. Yeah, no, it's not that it because I'm pretty uncomfortable like all the time, like in my own mind, like
really?
Like not to like an insane degree, but like I'm always like, I don't know, like I always feel like a level of weirdness when I'm talking to people, because I'm like, I'm always going through like the game plan in my mind, or like the like, okay, they said this, I'm going to say this.
Yeah.
They said that, I'm saying this. like thinking, I'm always thinking about what I'm, what, like what I'm supposed to say, or like what I, what I, what I am going to say, you know, or like, cause I try not to, like, I want to start conversations with people or like talk to people. And then sometimes it's just like, I don't really know what to talk about. And then I feel like, I feel really weird about like mundane conversations where I'm like, how's your day? You know, like, how's your day going? Cause sometimes it feels like more out of like obligation or just cause it's a default where I'm like, well, that's not exciting or interesting or fun for me to ask them that. Like, I don't think that that's like a fun thing personally. So if I have to do that, then I'm like, I've failed. I haven't started a proper, like, satisfying conversation for me. Cause I mean, maybe that's a bad way of approaching it, but like when I start conversations with people, I'm mainly focused on like deriving enjoyment from it for myself. Like I guess it's cause I'm not viewing it as a collaboration between two people, you know? And, you know, most of the time, like, obviously it's going to be just because by nature of participating in a conversation, you are collaborating. But
like,
I guess I'm selfish with my, with my conversations in the sense that I will force a conversation on somebody.
Huh.
Not like, not a specific topic or like a specific subject, but I just really, like, I'll interject myself. If I'm at work or whatever and I see two people talking, like, this was more of a thing when I was first starting, but mm-hmm. I would always go up and just kind of be like, what's going on, guys? What's up? What's happening? You're interacting with me now. You have no choice. It's me. Yeah. I don't care what you were talking about before. It's me. I'm here now. Talk to me. So that sort of thing.
I feel like the ones we did are
satisfactory. Yeah, I don't know. I feel good.
I'm sorry, you're talking to me. So can you repeat the question one more time?
I puff and I puff.
Auto.
And I gather my gumption. And I gather my gumption to make the assumption that I'm worth something. I'm full of lovin', and I've got a nice oven. Put your pizza within my chamber, and I swear you won't be in danger.
Popcorn Forest, episode number 5, featuring Luke Fisher. If you want to check out Popcorn Forest and support the show, you can do that on your browser by going to popcornforest.com, and there you'll find a support tab. You can also see the different places that Popcorn Forest is distributed. And possibly, it's coming to a theater near you. I think that's it for this week. We're going to have some show notes to take it out, but we're going to let this piano song play out. Oh, and have a great week. Thank you.
Okay, so show note number one comes from an article on phys.org, and this is from December 12th, 2017, entitled Personality and Mood Swings in Bacteria, put out by AMOLF, which I'm pronouncing AMOLF, and they are in the Netherlands. They are a kind of research institute. Their mission here on their website says to initiate and perform leading fundamental research on the physics of complex forms of matter and to create new functional materials in partnership with academia and industry. Okay, so back to phys.org. This is bacteria can control where they go using a signaling network of protein molecules. Scientists at AMOLF have developed a microscopy method that allows them to see how individual bacteria use this network to make decisions. They published that the bacteria are surprisingly diverse in personality and mood. The team published its findings in the scientific journal eLife on December 12, 2017. Bacteria, being single-celled organisms, do not have a nervous system, but are able to control their movements using a network of protein molecules that interact with us in a special way, much like the nerve cell circuits in our brain. For example, E. coli, a harmless bacterium that lives in our gut, knows how to interrupt its otherwise straight swimming motion by occasional tumbles that sets it off in new random direction, says Tom Shimizu, group leader of AMOLF's systems biology group. E. coli uses sensor proteins to detect things like food molecules or toxic chemicals to decide whether life is getting better or worse as it swims, and controls how often it tumbles to make sure it ends up in a good place. Zooming in on single cells. For many years, researchers have studied how these molecular circuits in bacteria like E. coli respond to changes in their surroundings. But this relied on experiments where the signal had to be averaged over hundreds of cells. Johannes Kiekstra, a PhD student in the group of Shimizu, led the effort to develop a microscopy method that enables researchers to see how the protein network in each individual bacterium responds to changes in the environment, for example, the abundance of food. Personality. The bacteria used in the experiments had the same DNA sequence, like identical twins, and were also grown under identical conditions. Nevertheless, researchers discovered that the protein network in each of them, personality, the bacteria used in the experiments had exactly the same DNA sequence, like identical twins, and were also grown under identical conditions. Nevertheless, the researchers discovered that the protein network in each of them behaves differently in the same chemical environment. Each bacterium seems to have its own personality, Kiekstra says. For example, we found that the chemical concentration to which bacteria respond varies considerably between bacteria. Mood. Apart from the clear differences in responses between bacteria, Shimizu and Kiekstra also saw that within each bacterium, the molecular activity could change considerably over time. They witnessed the way that protein molecules in bacteria interact to control movement is not steady, but is constantly varying in time, even in quiet environments with no changes in the amount of food or toxins. The moodiness of cells means that the mechanism with which they decide to tumble or swim straight on does not receive a steady input, but instead an input that varies randomly. The researchers believe that these varying molecular messages must be caused by chance events within the cell. We think that the bacterial individuality we found is not due to either nature, meaning DNA sequences, or nurture, meaning features of the environment, but rather to random events like molecular collisions inside the bacterium's single cell. A classic example of what physicists call noise, Shimizu says. Importantly, the bacteria did not produce any new proteins during the experiment. This means that while differences in personality could be caused by differences in protein levels between bacteria, the mood swings had to be the result of noise in how these proteins interact with each bacterium. I'm going to skip the rest of the article. There's a last little section that says random search for food. Okay, and then we also have an article coming from mdpi.com, which is looks like a scientific journal. In the header of the website, we've got a little menu that is showing that this is from the Journal of Transplantology, Volume 5, Issue 1. And the title of this is called Personality Changes Associated with Organ Transplant by a whole host of people, including Brian Carter and Levine Koshna. And let's see, I'm just kind of scrolling through here. I'm going to read the abstract. Personality changes have been reported following organ transplantation. Most commonly, such changes have been described among heart transplant recipients. We set out to examine whether personality changes occur following organ transplantation, and specifically, what types of changes occur among heart transplant recipients compared to other organ recipients. A cross-sectional study was conducted in which 47 participants, 23 of which were heart recipients and 24 were other organ recipients, completed an online survey. In this study, 89% of all transplant recipients reported personality changes after undergoing transplant surgery, which was similar for heart and other organ recipients. The only personality change that differed between heart and other organ recipients and that achieved statistical significance was a change in physical attributes. Differences in other types of personality changes were observed between these groups, but the number of participants in each group was too small to achieve statistical significance. Overall, the similarities between the two groups suggest heart transplant recipients may not be unique in their experience of personality changes following transplantation, but instead such changes may occur following the transplantation of any organ. With the exception of physical attributes, the types of personality changes reported were similar between the two groups. These findings indicate that the heart transplant recipients are not unique in their reported experience. Okay, that was like a duplicate sentence almost. Further studies are needed to deepen our understanding of what causes these personality changes. Then there's an introduction, and within the introduction, there's a heading called How Common Are Personality Changes Following Organ Transplantation? And this says, a Swedish study looked at the personality changes in 35 heart and kidney transplant recipients for 2 years following their surgery. The study found some recipients reported personality changes following surgery, but the frequency of these changes was not quantified. A Canadian study examined 27 adolescent heart transplant recipients and found that these individuals struggled to integrate their concepts of self and other, and several recipients experienced thoughts or questions about potentially acquiring characteristics of their donor via their donor's heart. No statistics were given for the frequency of personality changes. Then there's an Austrian study, and that says that it reported on the frequency of personality changes following heart transplantation. These investigators examined 47 heart transplant recipients, 3 months after transplant surgery, they found that 21% described changes in their personality and 79% reported no such changes. Then there's a U.S. study, blah, blah, blah. There's also a heading for types of personality changes. That kind of sounds interesting. We're talking about proposed causes and then just a lot of stuff about methods. I'm just kind of scrolling through, and this is into the discussion area here. Okay, not a super long article. Let's go back to the, here it is. Types of personality changes following transplant from the introduction section. Many different types of personality changes have been described following an organ transplantation. These include changes in preferences for food, music, art, sex, recreation, and career. The experience of new memories, feelings of euphoria, enhanced social and sexual adaptation, I wonder what that is, improved cognitive abilities, and spiritual or religious episodes. These changes were generally described as neutral or positive. However, troubling changes have also been reported. As many as 30 to 50% of heart transplant recipients experience emotional or affective issues, while others experience delirium, depression, anxiety, psychosis, and sexual dysfunction. A report in the lay literature describes the case of Claire Sylvia, who reported changes in her personality, preferences, and behaviors following a heart and lung transplant at Yale New Haven Hospital in 1988. Following surgery, Sylvia developed a new taste for green peppers and chicken nuggets, food she previously disliked. That's crazy. As soon as she was released from the hospital, she promptly headed to a Kentucky Fried Chicken in order to order chicken nuggets. She later met her donor's family and inquired about his affinity for green peppers. Their response was, "Are you kidding? He loved them. But what he really loved was chicken nuggets." That is so crazy. Sylvia later discovered that at the time of her donor's death in a motorcycle accident, a container of chicken nuggets was found under his jacket. Okay, and then in addition to changes in preferences, some recipients described new aversions after receiving a donor heart. For example, a 5-year-old boy received the heart of a 3-year-old boy but was not informed about his donor's age or cause of death. Despite this lack of information, he provided a vivid description of his donor after surgery. He's just a little kid. He's a little brother, like about half my age. He got hurt bad when he fell down. He likes Power Rangers a lot, I think, just like I used to. I don't like them anymore, though. Subsequently, it was reported that his donor had died after falling from an apartment window while trying to reach a Power Ranger toy that had fallen onto a window ledge. After receiving his new heart, the recipient refused to touch or play with Power Rangers. So, interesting stuff. I should mention that just because these resources appear to be credible, that you should always check into the stuff that you're researching. And from where I'm sitting, this is just an interesting sort of philosophical inquiry to expand on some of the conversation that Luke and I had in our episode, but that I would not come away from either of these things thinking that it was definitively conclusive. There's just so much in science about making assertions that it is kind of nice when it's just interesting, curious stories. And that is finishing up show notes for this week.
from the Meadowlark.